starting in just a minute. We're waiting for one panelist to arrive, so bear with us for 1 minute, please. While we're waiting for our final panelists to arrive, let me start with the housekeeping and administrative matters. Welcome to the session on governance issues related to critical internet resources. Let me introduce our panel today. Their detailed biographies can be found at the workshop description on the IGF website, so I'll just introduce them by name today. Starting from my left is Jim Dempsey from the Center of Democracy and Technology. Then Gurumurthy Kisinathan from IT for Change in India. Carlos Afonso from Brazil. Milton Mueller from the University, from Syracuse University. To his left is Fernando Barrio from Argentina and London. And at the end of the table, we have Willie Curry from South Africa. Today's discussion is going to proceed along the following lines. First, we'll have an introduction from Jim Dempsey, who will set up the proposition by mapping, if you will, what constitutes critical internet resources and how those critical internet resources might be governed. This is to provide a snapshot, a foundation for the rest of the discussion. We'll then hear a perspective on that from Fernando Barrio and from Rajneesh Singh, if he arrives. We'll then proceed, after the setting the foundation, to the part of the session that will deal with what if, what could be, what are the processes for establishing governance, how do we define governance, and what is its evolution as applied to critical internet resources. That discussion will start off by Guru, and then we'll hear. Okay. Rajneesh is coming. We'll also hear from Carlos, Milton, and Willie on those issues. So let me put a little bit in context. We've heard already from the main session some indications of the main issues that we'll be discussing here today, and we hope to get into them in a bit more detail. Bob Kahn, in his remarks on Monday, postulated that what we have right now with ICON and the domain names is really a way to semantically moderate IP addressing. It didn't have to be that way. It's just the way it is. If we were developing something fresh today, how would we do it? What governance structures would we put on it? And how would we proceed to do that? And I'd like the panel to think about and respond to some questions. One is, what are the problems that we're trying to deal with? What are we trying to solve here? Are the governance structures that exist or that could exist, will they really address those problems? And what structures might we recommend with regard to those problems and those governance issues? I'd like the panel to please limit each of your opening remarks to 10 minutes if possible. I'll be keeping strict time. Because I'd like to leave time for questions and answers after the session. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim Dempsey. Thank you.
David, thank you. Again, I'm Jim Dempsey with the Center for Democracy and Technology, and I want to thank David Sotola and Parminder for organizing this panel. If I could have the first slide, please. I think, okay. Let me, you get to see my whole presentation here. No? Oh, that's not what I intended to do. You had You had the right presentation. It just wasn't the first slide. There we go. You know, in talking about critical internet resources and in talking about internet governance, from my perspective at least, the place to start is by asking, what kind of an internet do we want? Because the kind of internet that you want should determine the kind of governance structures that will get you there. And conversely, in evaluating proposals for changes in internet governance structures, the question to ask is, where are these governance structures likely to take you? So there can be different visions of what the internet should look like. We know that certainly there is not currently around the world a shared vision of what the internet should be. This is my vision, the CDT vision. I think you could say it's the human rights and development oriented vision, which is an internet that is widely accessible, affordable, open. Open is a weighted term. To me, openness means that any user can reach any content on the internet on a non-discriminatory basis, that the network can handle a wide range of applications, that devices can be connected to the internet without the permission of network operators, that openness is really embedded in the end-to-end principle, which was part of my interpretation, at least, of where the internet came from. But the internet that I would want is an internet that is innovative, that supports innovation, that is trusted, in that privacy is protected, and that people can have confidence that their information, their communications will not be compromised or intercepted, that is secure, and that supports free expression. Now, what does it take to get there? Why am I having such trouble with this? Thank you. What does it take to get there? And this is really my interpretation, my definition of what is critical to the internet. And you notice that in this list, we proceed from IP addressing numbers and domain names, the system of root name servers, protocols and standards, bandwidth, all the way down to electricity. Now, to some extent, how you define critical internet resources depends literally on where you live geographically. And certainly for people in Africa, electricity is a critical internet resource. If you could give me the next slide, please. We can look at who governs these critical internet resources. And what we see is a diversity of institutions and a diversity of modes of governance, ranging from the purely private, in fact, voluntary standards bodies like the Internet Engineering Task Force, to government-dominated governance structures. And you also notice that many of the elements of internet resources are primarily regulated or governed at the national level, not at the global level. Now, I tried one time, actually, Mike Nelson of IBM and ISOC did a version of this chart, and I have to admit I stole it from him. But it's possible to sort of map these institutions on a chart, one axis being from governance institutions that involve no government to those that are purely governmental in nature, and governance institutions that basically are governance arrangements that occur at the individual level, all the way up to those that are international in nature. Now, we could debate endlessly where specific elements belong on this chart and whether online privacy should be a little bit more on the governmental side or a little bit more on the user control side, et cetera. But this gives you an example of some of the institutions that participate in internet governance and where they fall in terms of the taxonomy of government, non-government, global, or local. What is good governance is an important question to ask. What do we want from governance? We want transparency, accountability, predictability. The question of representativeness and what is representativeness is a question worth debating, but certainly in a area such as the internet, governance should be representative, participatory. And again, bringing in the human rights and development perspective, governance should involve a commitment to human rights and development. So the path forward, I think that in discussing where to go, if what changes, if any, should be made to internet governance, the task is to identify the barriers that exist to internet development, to identify the governance structures that are currently responsible for those barriers. And as I said, many of those barriers are at the national level. And then to ask, would a change in governance structures make an improvement? Would it get us closer to a vision of the internet, whatever one's vision of the internet is? Again, mine is based upon openness, user control, affordability, availability, and the support for democracy. And I think the last point should be in rearranging this, if at all, to keep in mind the Hippocratic principle. This is a bust of Hippocrates. Do no harm. We've made, in my view, remarkable progress in the development of the internet with a governance structure that combines a variety of methodologies, a variety of structures, and a change to that structure must proceed from the do no harm principle. Will a particular proposal advance the vision of an open, widely available, affordable, user-controlled, trusted internet, or might it jeopardize the progress that has been made so far and end up having unintended consequences?
Thank you, Jim. Can we have the next presentation put up, please, number two?
We're loading that I've prepared a paper of which we have copies at the table here that goes into greater detail on these ideas.
Thank you. Right, thank you for giving me this opportunity to rant a little bit on some of the issues we face. Now, other panelists in this session will likely talk about critical internet governance, critical internet resource governance, perhaps with some reference to past and present issues and concerns. I would like to take a step back from that and offer some perspectives on the wider IG situation in the developing region of the world where I happen to be resident at the moment, the Pacific Islands. Now, just to give you a quick recap of Pacific Island demographics, if this works. Okay, the Pacific Islands exist over some 35 million square kilometers of sea. Now, we often refer to it as the liquid continent because of its vast size. Population ranges from less than 1,000 people to over 5 million. The common theme across the region is one of remote communities living with the tyranny of distance. The most pressing issue in the region is obviously one of access. Okay. Now, but access has many forms, as Jim has touched on during his presentation, ranging from content to infrastructure to electricity to finance. In a technical sense, critical internet resources would have most relevance to internet provision infrastructure, which is highlighted in black, yep, it's come through, which would perhaps cover in some form or another IP addresses, root servers, DNSSEC, and so on and so forth. However, some also define some of the other access issues listed as CIRs as well, with electricity being one of the most often referred to. I do not wish to get into defining what is a CIR and what is not, as the most likely result will be we will agree to disagree on the definition. Rather, I would like to offer some comments on what some of the issues are with formulating and implementing governance frameworks in a region such as the Pacific Islands. So, if we look at the set of people involved, or perhaps who should be involved in governance frameworks in the Pacific, they generally suffer from a poor understanding of internet technology from a policy perspective. What I mean by this is that they know what the internet is, what the potential is, and so on, but they do not really understand the policy aspects behind the technology. Part of this stems from a lack of exposure at the policymaker level. It's not that they do not want to be involved, it's that they simply cannot, because in most of the islands and territories, the policymakers are a very small group. In some countries, just one person, who are tasked with a whole range of responsibilities, and one or two persons can only do so much, as you would imagine. This then leads to a lack of policy development capacity. Now, let me give you an example. Earlier this year, the Internet Society convened the Pacific Regulators and Policymakers Summit to discuss, among other things, internet governance. With the assistance of the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat, invitations were sent to 14 countries, out of which 8 people representing 6 countries turned up. These invitations were fully sponsored, so there was no cost to the country. All expenses were catered for. The 8 people turning up was actually an outstanding result, as we only expected around 4. The others could not attend because of simple human resource issues. Some were attending events elsewhere. Some countries had national elections coming up, which required senior civil servants to stay in the country for other duties, and so on. What makes the problem worse is when they do get a chance to attend an event which discusses internet governance issues, they get a bewildering amount of information, including different points of view and interpretations, which they just cannot deal with because there are more pressing issues at home, like radio spectrum allocations, or numbering plans, or deregulation, or like in the case of Fiji, where I'm from, military coups. This one issue of human resources, or the lack thereof, leads to very little involvement from the Pacific Islands in events such as this. Even looking at ICANN's GAC meetings show that there's little or no Pacific Islands participation. The last participation was probably at ICANN Wellington in early 2006, and this was more because a ministerial meeting was held concurrent to the ICANN meeting. So what then is the solution? The region is rapidly embracing internet technologies, there's no doubt about that. Net cafes are springing up all over the place. Broadband is being progressively introduced in many markets. For economies that can sustain it, deregulation is showing signs of life. Various regional initiatives are underway to alleviate access issues. This means more and more Pacific Islanders will be online, and sooner or later, governance issues will and effective frameworks to safeguard the internet and its users will become all the more important. There are organizations like the Internet Society and others who are considering how best to address the issue. Now, it is likely the region will always have human resource and policy capacity issues. There's no doubt about that. One solution, and this is a personal opinion, is the concept of regional governance framework set up in such a manner that they can be rapidly applied at the national or subnational level. We may perhaps rather call it a best practice guide structured to the needs of the region. This will likely take a lot of effort and lots of agreeing to disagree, but is the only practical way forward for the region to latch on to when things start going wrong. Of course, when things start going wrong, it may be a tad too late, but having a regional framework in place may mean that as countries look at the national ICT strategies and policies, parts of the governance framework that they have in place, or best practice, if you like, can be quickly adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Rajneesh. Can we have the next presentation up, please? Number three. And I'll turn the floor over to Fernando Barrio.
Sorry, I just got accustomed to teach, and I do it that better. Unfortunately, this is a very strange situation because the students know far more than me as today. So the first issue is what are these critical internet resources? And I tried to come up with a proper definition and with a list, and I couldn't. Because the first issue we have is something, what is critical is something sine qua non, something that without that we wouldn't be able to function. And due to the main characteristics of internet that most of you know far, far better than me, it is very difficult to find without any doubt something that will mean, okay, without this we don't have internet. Of course, you will say that there are things like that. For example, a remote control that doesn't have enough power, things like that. But the definition of what is critical and what things are critical are many, and they are various, and they are different. There is the only thing that we can agree here is that there is no complete agreement of what these critical internet resources are. And in addition, any definition will be inexact. So if we try to look for this list, we will see that most people will agree that IP addresses are clearly a necessary part. If you try to send a package and the package doesn't know where it's going, probably will never arrive. Okay, you got me one, there is someone. Then electricity, without electricity, it's probably clear that we will not be able to have internet, and therefore it is a critical internet resource. But then human resources, some people could imagine an internet where machines run everything in the not-so-distant future, but still I think that human resources and the formation of the human resources must be considered as a critical internet resource. And then funding. We all are here talking about very important things like democracy and everything, but somebody has to pay for things that are going on, and somebody has to pay for our flights to come here too. And then another resource that sometimes is not considered is users. Everything that we said here is very, very nice, but without users, internet will die. So this is becomes very important when we talk about governance, because any form of governance that doesn't take into account the main, probably the main critical resource, that is the users, is doomed from the very beginning. Another of these critical internet resources is the domain name system. And here we probably will agree. There is some discussion about that, because when you use a telephone, you don't need to dial a name. You dial a number, and sometimes a very complex number, and it works. So there is an argument to say that without the domain name system, internet still will work. So whether it's critical or not is a matter of discussion, but there is some sort a form of agreement that we should consider as a critical internet resource. In addition, it's one that allows me to do the analysis that I want to do, because the domain name system, as I said, has many issues and can be analyzed in many different ways. But we could talk about trademark infringement and many legal issues, but today the idea is to talk about the relation with critical internet resources, just as an excuse to analyze something else that will show how governance might affect that. Because the domain name system is, for the next one I will give mine because this is ICANN. We could argue that in a way, the domain name system is clearly linked with ICANN. And therefore, without being this about ICANN, my intention is not to talk about ICANN. ICANN is the excuse to talk of what I really want to talk, that is the legal complexities. Something that David referred when introducing us, my idea is just to show a picture. We will not take off the gloves and start a fight here, not today. The idea is just to show a picture. These are the legal issues that ICANN shows or ICANN can help us to understand. But remember, this is not about ICANN. So, the first thing that we have to once and for all agree is ICANN is a regulator. The other day I have a very interesting conversation of somebody very involved, say, oh, I'm up for self-regulation. Somebody that is working in the ultimate domain name system regulator, that is ICANN. Why I said that when anybody that has been in an ICANN meeting already said, oh no, we don't regulate, we just discuss and we inform and develop policy. Well, normally a regulator is the one that has the power to set the price of things. Normally a regulator give accreditation to people to do things, and a regulator can make new public offerings, and also a regulator will have the power of enforcement. If you have any doubt about that, well, you probably will know what happened with VeriSign when they have this VeriSign search facility a couple of years ago, when I can clearly say, you do that again, you will lose your registration rights. So the problems that we are discussing here and that the host country put from the beginning is the issues of ICANN and the governance of internet through ICANN, you could argue that it's a purely legal issue. And you would say, wait a minute, another lawyer that wants to take over the world. And I know that you don't want a lawyer to be ruling anything. It's clear that you said, wait a minute, we are fine with the geeks, don't bring lawyers. Furthermore, you would say, an Argentinian talking about respecting the rules. This sounds a little funny, I understand that. But I have some reasons to question who will guard the guards. So if ICANN is the main regulator, but we don't recognize it. So if they are the ones who can tell us how to do things or when to do things and how much we have to pay for things, but we cannot regulate them. So as the Romans used to say, who guards the guards? Who take care? Who makes sure that I can fulfill the role that is fulfilling, by the way, and in which I will say this from the very beginning, I think that should keep fulfilling, but we have to discuss the legal issue, how and why. So, normally, a regulator will have to have a clear mandate for authorizing to do what it's doing. That it happened in any country, in any jurisdiction, and with any regulator. On the other hand, it have to have this mandate have to be very clear and expressed. Have to say you can do from here to here. Why? This will be very important and quite evident in few minutes. In 1 minute because we have two, and then the internal processes should be established too when the regulator is created, so you know whether those processes are being followed properly or not. And finally, there should be judicial review. What happens if things don't go the way? Well, you should have the right to go to court. And people say, oh, another lawyer talking. The issue that we are forgetting here, probably because too many people that know a lot about computers are here, they forget the technical standards are a policy decision. When you decide the technical standard, you are not deciding technical issues, you are making a policy decision. When you have at least two standards and you choose one, you made a policy decision. Who gave you the right to do that? It's very nice to come here all the way to Rio and talk about democracy, openness, but then, for example, why the Register of Mexico was in the Technological Institute of Monterrey, just because somebody there was friend of the person that created the original assigned numbers authority, just because of that. Am I criticizing that? No. Well, it's the way that happened. So we shouldn't go there and start criticizing, but we should know it. We should know that, so when we discuss what we are discussing here, we don't keep doing this sort of exercise, as I call intellectual masturbation, in which, oh yeah, this is like that, this is like that, and then nothing happens. So we have to be clear and have no problem in to recognize where we are. So let's analyze specifically the case of ICANN. No, without mentioning that political oversight is also necessary. Here is when people say, oh, wait a minute, we don't want political oversight. The problem is when you don't recognize it, the political oversight happened anyway, but in the back door, as it is happening now. So now it will be very naive to deny that there are political pressures in ICANN and in every organization. Remember, ICANN is the example. It's not here, the focus is not the target. It's just the example. And political pressure from certain countries does exist, and we have to recognize it. Therefore, we put it in the instrument that authorized the regulator to regulate. So let's see how it works specifically in the ICANN case. One more minute. In the ICANN case situation, we will have that the authorization comes from a memorandum of understanding. Eventually, this will work. A memorandum of understanding between now ICANN and the Department of Trade of the United States. It was not the Congress that created a regulator. It's a memorandum of understanding. The legal nature of that is at best very tenuous, especially if you have a problem. Then ICANN per se is a non-profit institution incorporated in the state of California. So if you have a problem, you will have to go to California. I know it's very nice, sunny, we love to go there, but probably you will have other things to do before that. Then, between ICANN and the NICS, the problem is it's just a contract in most cases. Then, in some cases, before ICANN was created, was a transfer of rights between IANA and the NICS, like for example in the case of Argentina, and there the legal relation becomes even more confusing. So, what I'm trying to say is that what happens if you have a conflict? Because I know nobody likes lawyers, and I agree with that. And we could spend a whole forum making jokes about lawyers. Most of them are actually true, not jokes. But the point is, everything that you are saying is very nice. But when we are deciding between a standard, we are deciding between many things, what happens if there is conflict? Because the aura is, we will do things by consensus. Yes. If you read the ICANN by law, says we will have consensus. If we don't have it, the board will decide, which means somebody have to take a decision. And what happens when the decision is not the one you want? What happens when there is conflict? Well, if we understand where we are, we might know where we want to go. So if we have conflict, first, administrative U.S. law. If you have a problem in the memorandum of understanding, if you think that, for example, you propose a top-level domain name, and ICANN denies, and you believe that that had to do anything with pressure of United States government, you say, wait a minute, they didn't like it because a particular ideology now in the White House, and IAMGATE denied that. As we all know, there is a lot of money behind top-level domain names. So can you challenge that? Well, it's a very complex issue of administrative U.S. law, but you might be in Fiji, and you don't want to go to U.S. court. And then what happened if you believe that an internal decision of ICANN was not taken properly? Where do you go? Well, then I'll see you in California. So, furthermore, and I'm finishing, David, promise. He doesn't believe me anyway. Furthermore, when you have a problem between ICANN and different countries, you will have to enter in what in many countries is called international private law, but as most lawyers know, international private law doesn't exist. What is called is really conflict of laws. It's part of an internal law of the country. It's not international at all. So if you have a contractual problem between an Argentinian and an American, well, the first thing that you have to decide is which law will apply, but it's national law. And that is inside the national laws. There is no treaty for that. So when you have a problem with ICANN, the first year you will be in court trying to decide which law will apply, because you will have to apply conflict of law. I know what you are asking here. Do we have, or do I propose any solutions? Because it's very easy to throw stones. But as David said, unfortunately, it's nothing to do with me. Time's up.
Thank you very much, Fernando. Guru, can we ask you to, and may we have presentation number 4 up, please?
Thanks, David. Thanks for moderating and co-organizing this workshop. Can I have the slides up, please? I just want to start, while that's coming up, to give a very brief background of why we are doing this workshop and why CIR and the governance of CIR is so critical. I go back to the opening session of this IGF, where one of the civil society speakers said, CIR may be important, but access is more important, and let's not waste too much time talking about CIRs. In my presentation, I'm going to talk about why governance of CIR is really probably one of the most important things that the IGF needs to worry about, and I'm going to talk about what we can do about it, so my presentation is a bit normative. My time's not up, so I hope my slides can come on. And in my presentation, basically, there are 3 points that I'm going to touch on, but I'll wait for the slide to come. Yeah. Yeah. So my presentation is titled Governance of Critical Internet Resources. I'll call it CIR in short. I have only 10 minutes, and it makes sense to use a short form. Exploring Commons and Public Interest-Based Frameworks. Yes, I have this gizmo here. So my presentation basically is going to touch on 3 points. First, I'm going to submit to this group that the issue of governance is a political issue. And it's a very important discussion, whether it's technical, it's only technical, it's only meant for technical specialists, it's not meant for the rest of you, because it's not a political issue. I'm going to talk about that. Secondly, I'm going to talk about, having accepted that it is an intensely political process, the need to bring in a concept of the public into this governance discourse and elaborate a little bit on what is this public, why is it required to get into the governance discourse. And thirdly, after having talked about why the public is very important, I'm going to give you a proposal, because it's not sufficient to just sit in theory and say public is important. What does it mean? I'm going to present a proposal to this group on how we can actually bring the public into the realm of the IG discourse. The first thing is, the history of this whole CIR governance has been as follows. But in the WSIS process, and even until very recently, it was very strongly held by some groups that critical internet resources is a technical area, and the way it's going on right now is perfectly fine. ICANN is doing an excellent job. It doesn't matter if ICANN is subordinate to a single government in this world, doesn't matter at all. The security and stability of the internet, which is a completely technical area, is very important, and therefore demands for making this governance a more multi-stakeholder process, one that involves more countries, more people, more societies, that's not required, because that will destabilize the internet. It's completely technical. And I'm going to point out how this argument is completely flawed, completely false, by taking the most extreme case. My previous speaker spoke about how CIR can have a variety of interpretations. I'm going to take the narrowest interpretation, which is names and numbers. Everybody in this room will agree with me when I say that names and numbers is certainly CIR. Whether electricity is CIR or not can be contested, we can debate it. But I'm sure nobody in this room will say names and numbers is not CIR. And I want to point to 3 examples which clearly shows that even names and numbers is a political issue, it's not a technical issue. We are familiar with the whole issue of the .xxx TLD, which came to ICANN, and it was discussed and debated, and there were strong views for it, strong views against it. To me, it doesn't matter what a particular view is. The very fact that there are multiple views on a particular issue clearly takes it out of the realm of the technical, brings it into the realm of the political. Meaning that a body that's looking at purely technical issues cannot then get into issues of governance. In fact, one of the reasons why the TLD request was rejected also was on the grounds that it is a political issue, and ICANN is not maybe the best body to look at issues like that. Even the issue of the IDN TLDs, the multilingual TLDs, the progress, very slow progress in them, certainly is a matter to me of the way the governance structures are there currently today. I'll talk a little about it in my last part of the presentation. And of course, this whole IPv4 to IPv6 movement, we all know that if the people who need IPv6 are very different from the people who have IPv4 today. It's clearly a complementing set. And the interests of the people who have IPv4 are affected by the transition negatively. The people who don't have computers and devices today want IPv6. And it's clearly a debate between the two because transition has costs. So why aren't we making any movement on it? Why are we still waiting? Everybody says that it's a matter of time before IPv4 runs out. So why is IGF, why is ICANN not doing as much as is required to make sure the transition happens? ICANN to me is a euphemism for the entire governance framework. The idea is not to take one in single institution, but why are the current governance structures not doing what it is required to make sure that it happens? Again, it points out to the intensely political nature of the IPv4, IPv6 movement. Yeah, I think the last point, I won't explain every point on the slide, again in the interest of time, but if you have questions, I'll take it post the talk. Why is it the way it is? And to me, from India, from the developing world, from the global south, it's very clear that the priorities of the current governance structures are dictated by who's a part of that. Interestingly, whether it's business, whether it's civil society, whether it's governments, we find that a small subset of humanity is present here, and they are taking the decisions for the rest of humanity, and that applies to all the three groups, and that explains why the decisions are made the way they are. I'm going to talk a little bit about how this whole, I already talked about the technical aspect and how that argument is clearly flawed. We have a new concept today of the neutrality concept. And for example, you must have heard the whole campaign of keep the core neutral, which argues that at a global level, we should not have any issues on accepting any GTLD that comes in. And you know, nation states can do what they want. And I am very uncomfortable with that idea because the whole idea of public policy is how do you make positive rights happen? The whole notion of United Nations human rights, the whole 1948 UN DHR issue was to push for global acceptance of the concept of human rights so that nation states couldn't then say, no, we can't have it. So keeping the core neutral is not a good idea for many countries because then authoritarian regimes at national level can take away freedoms. And therefore, I'm not comfortable with the concept as keeping the core neutral. We need to be positive about it, but we need to be positive in a way to make more human rights possible at a global level. The last point in this is like to say that I don't know that ICANN is the right organization or not, and to me, ICANN is just another organization. Either ICANN needs to acquire legitimacy by getting more people onto its governance to make it accountable to the whole of humanity because it governs the whole of humanity and it can't be accountable to a single government or a set of governments. I think legitimacy, representation are extremely essential to making the governance a more valid and legitimate process. Oops, I have just 2 more minutes. So I'll just very quickly go through this. The whole issue of, I have spoken about the governance realm and now I'm talking about the issue of public and the private. And we find that whether it's IP discourse or whether it's traditional knowledge, public knowledge is under significant attack. And there is a huge set of moves to commercialize appropriate knowledge for the private domain. And I want to clarify here that public is not synonymous with state, which is how probably it was several decades back. Public clearly includes civil society. Public includes community. And along with the government, the notion is of non-exclusion, of inclusion, whereas private clearly is the area of exclusion. There are a couple of quotes I want to talk about about this increasing move to privatize traditional knowledge, to privatize common knowledge, and how it's impacting the people, particularly from the developing world. Since I don't have much time, I should just go to the next slide. This again, another quote. Now we find that same thing, when it comes to internet governance, we find that there is a very strong, predominant push of private commercial interests. That is not wrong per se, but it's become so lopsided that there is no space for cooperation and collaboration. If you look at the 1998 principles of ICANN, competition is enshrined as a very crucial principle in it. And ICANN in its own motto says, fostering competition is important. And the whole assumption is that innovation is clearly a private sector arena, and cooperation has nothing to do with innovation, which is a challengeable notion. The whole issue of in governance, when we look at life, we have a role for the shop, which is functioning on commercial principles. That's a business, and that's perfectly fine. It should be there. But there's also a garden. There's also a library. And no spirit of competition, no market is going to bring that shop, going to bring the garden or the library around. We need to have the same notion of the garden in the internet governance era as well. And therefore, the proposal from IT for Change is, just like we have the .com GTLD, commerce, business, perfectly valid. I'm not saying markets don't exist. Markets are a very important place. But we need to complement that with the public space as well. So I think that in all fairness, we should have a .gpd, a .global public domain, in which all the public knowledge, traditional knowledge, common knowledge is placed and available for everybody. So this .gpd will have a default copyright of no copyright. It's available for all. Once a knowledge is placed in the .gpd, it can't then be privatized. So the idea of the .gpd is it becomes a thrust to increasing the level of public knowledge in the world. We all know that publicly funded research is large quantities of that are produced, but increasingly they're getting privatized. And the idea of .gpd is to give a thrust to the whole process of creating, producing, uploading knowledge from traditional sources, from traditional communities. And of course, this doesn't mean everything is at the global level. A lot of effort on appropriating public knowledge for the public needs to be happening at the national level, at the local level. But as far as the governance of CIR is concerned, the governance of names and numbers is concerned, .gpd as a GTLD is a responsibility of the current bodies that are taking care of governance of IG. This is, you might think this is a very revolutionary and pioneering idea. It is not. If you look at the GNSO proposal on new GTLDs, they have suggested that developing countries, if they want GTLDs, it should be at a differential pricing. So therefore, everything is not on the typical market-based or competition-based kind of thinking, but that there needs to be differential nature. The role of public policy is emphasized there. Similarly, in the .xxx proposal, it was rejected, but the suggestion that some part of the money should go for providing screening filters to parents who don't want content to be seen by their children. So these are two proposals which have the public interest at heart, and the .gpd is one such. We talked about this in the Access main session. I don't know how many of you were there. We talked about this whole notion of the next billion. And the visas, DOP clearly talks about an inclusive society. When you talk of inclusion, it can't be including people 1 billion by 1 billion. And you know that by the time the last billion comes onto the internet, it's decades down the line. And believe me, it's the most difficult to get people who are further more and more marginalized than the rest of us. And internet governance has to clearly be done in a way that we're able to rapidly get the remaining part of humanity into it. It is no point. We are really an elite club. 1 billion is still 15% of humanity, which is an exclusive elite club. And governance has to do better than that. We need to ask questions of the governance, people who are in the process of governance, to get better results than the what we have got so far. Time is up. Yeah. This is my last slide. I think so what? I think apart from the .gpd, we are looking at push for multilingual domains, the IDN. We're looking for push to IPv6 so that developing countries will have more access to IP addresses. We are looking at new GTLDs coming in, and certainly we're looking at the .gpd coming in. Yeah. I think that's all. So I'll end my slide with that GTLD. This is what I hope IGF will become. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Guru. I'd now like to turn the floor over to Carlos Afonso from Brazil. Carlos?
Wow. Okay, excellent presentations so far. I would like to stress some points which I think is a discussion which comes from the WC's process, and especially within the IGF, the WGIG, the Working Group on Internet Governance, from which the definition of critical internet resources in a summarized fashion is being used to justify its inclusion in the main thematic list of the IGF. This definition itself was the result of a very disputed situation in which different ideas and different opinions were were consolidated. And so the definition was completely, in my view, useless, because it's so general that, I would get that definition and say, content is the mother of all critical internet resources. So let's start from there and then go down in the scale. Health may be a critical internet resource. People without health cannot really navigate on the internet, sit down and work, etc. No? Housing and so on. Electricity, of course, etc., etc. So this definition is unworkable in a seminar like this. Even with that, there was a strong resistance for the first phase of the IGF to include it in the main among the main themes. No? And it was only included in the second because of the concerns raised by several groups, several countries, regarding the importance of discussing some of these critical internet resources in the context of the IGF, which worry a lot of people and countries, etc. I am following here the document circulated by the CDT. It's a sort of Internet 101 revisited. And I am a bit worried about the way they describe the relationship of ICANN with US government. And this is the critical internet resource I would like to talk about here. It says clearly here that in theory, long enough was the two-year period for the first memorandum of understanding. It was long enough for the fledgling nonprofit company to establish a stable control over the DNS and to develop a robust and transparent decision-making process that represented the needs of the all internet users. However, says the CDT, the contract has been repeatedly renewed, most recently in 2006 for up to 5 years. And then in the next paragraph, they say that some participants in the WCS process expressed the satisfaction that the US government has retained veto power over some ICANN decisions, a power the US government has never used. Wow. This is open to a lot of debates, first of all, and second, why, if the US government does not intend to use this power, why do they insist so much in renewing the memo of understanding? Why do they insist so much in keeping the ritual for editing the root zone file, which has always any modification to go through a ritual in the Department of Commerce for approval? No? So, I am worried about this, and many countries, many organizations, many sectors are worried about this. And then it goes on to quote that people regarding this concern have proposed in the discussion since the WCS an alternative, which would be to replace ICANN with the ITU. And this is the only alternative that is described here. And this is a very important other alternatives, such as the one which is being defended by many in the caucus of civil society, the civil society caucus, by several other international organizations and national organizations, by countries, etc., that what we are not talking about replacing it. There is another alternative, which is to make ICANN international, multi-stakeholder, transparent, and independent from any government, including the government of the United States. So this is an important aspect which is missing here. No? And today in the morning, we had a debate on the NSSEC, the security extensions using cryptography technologies for securing the DNS route. And which countries which are usually pointed at as the countries that want to change ICANN into something that we do not like? No? China, Russia, etc. No. It was Germany who raised a fundamental issue, the fundamental issue that the root will have an enhanced function, a security function, which is still centralized within the reach of the US government. And that was raised by the CCTLD operator of Germany, .de, which has 11 million domains, and he is worried about implementing DNSSEC, even within their own country, because of certain technological hurdles that have not been overcome yet. So this is a concern which has to be taken into account. These concerns have to be taken into account. They cannot be played down. Very soon, China and India will have most of the internet users by far. These countries are concerned about it. Most of the internet users by far will be in China and India very soon, you know. Countries like Brazil, which keeps a very special relationship with ICANN, we work with ICANN, we work intensely with ICANN. We are participating in ICANN through its internal processes. He's worried about it. It is always expressing its concern. Brazil has almost 200 million people, no? Has today almost 30 million people on the internet. These are concerns that have to be heard, cannot play down, cannot be just put under a carpet. This is what I want to stress. And ICANN itself, not only a few members of the board, is recognizing the finally the importance of this. Just read the letter from Vint Cerf, the farewell letter that he published in the ICANN site, which he says specifically that ICANN, internationalization of ICANN should be done because it's beneficial for the system. And last year, a working group within ICANN was commissioned by the chair, by the board, sorry, to do a study of internationalization and came up with a proposal favoring internationalization. Some people say that the main concern there was that ICANN is subject to a lot of litigation within U.S. law, so they want to do this kind of internationalization for this purpose. Okay, whatever, but let's discuss this. Please, this is important. ICANN must understand this is important. All members of the board of ICANN must understand this is important. The so-called internet community, these people like to call themselves the internet community and forget us, the users, forget the billions of other people who are using the internet. They are also the internet community. This restricted internet community, please understand this is a concern that the rest of the world, many in the rest of the world, probably the majority of internet users very soon, are raising as a serious issue. Let's take this into account. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carlos. Milton, can you kick off, please?
Well, I was invited to a panel that I thought was going to be about governance frameworks for critical internet resources. And in particular, I was interested in engaging with IT for Change about the idea of commons and property in the governance of these resources. I think my colleagues have done most of the work here, but I want to make my position clear. It is pointless to have a broad definition of critical internet resources. We all know what the debate is about. It's a code word for ICANN issues. That's really all you need to know. We can have a coherent discussion of global governance of internet identifier resources. We cannot have a coherent discussion of governance if it confuses global, national, and local issues, and if it combines ICANN with things like electrical power, literacy, global warming, the food supply, and erectile dysfunction. So what am I going to talk about then, now that I hope I've disposed of that? I'm interested and have done a recent paper as a long-term research agenda on the commons and private property regimes in internet governance. Increasingly perhaps, this is treated as a dichotomy in which you have the advocates of the commons, the info-communists, raising the banner of open access, non-exclusivity, freedom of access to open internet resources. And on the other hand, you have the advocates of the market, of private property, of exclusively exchanged resources on the market. Now, I have looked at this and thought about it to some degree in both historically and contemporary circumstances, and it's pretty evident that there are many instances in which private property and commons interact in a mutually supportive and productive way. And one of the critical examples of this is the internet itself, in which you have the open, non-proprietary standards, binding everybody together in a compatible format. And at the same time, you have privately owned networks and privately owned servers and privately owned websites and content being distributed across this globally compatible and open network. Anyway, we should have learned from history that any attempt to do away completely with one or the other, that is, to do away completely with private property or with commons, can be disastrous. Try to imagine a world in which there is no public sector or which there is no private property. In order to understand this relationship, we need to know a bit about theory derived from economics. Has to do with transactions costs, externalities, and so on. But let me give you a couple of examples of how these two things can interact and why you may tend towards one or the other. Typically, you find commons regimes being established not because people suddenly become soft-hearted and devoted to sharing, but because of the minimizing the transactions cost associated with appropriation of a resource. For example, if you have a field in which sheep are grazing and there's plenty of grassland for them all to graze on, and nobody really stops anybody else from fully feeding their sheep, then you really don't need private property. You can simply treat it as a commons. In other cases, you might want to actually legally institute a commons, and one of the interesting cases that's more contemporary here is when you have so many private property claims on technology through the patent system that nobody can move. Nobody can make any new technology without being challenged. This is called the tragedy of the anti-commons, and it's an example in which the private property system becomes dysfunctional. And you need to establish a commons or an open database in which everybody can draw on an unrestricted basis. So those are just two simple examples. Now, our group, the Internet Governance Project, has advanced this idea of network neutrality as a globally applicable principle. And this is quite relevant to this discussion because in doing that, what we were trying to do was try to find another one of these creative combinations of private and common. By promoting net neutrality, we were trying to make sure that the network operators, who constitute not monopolies anymore, thank God, but oligopolies sometimes, fairly restricted markets often, that these do not become gatekeepers and barriers to the exchange of information, whether those gatekeeping functions are imposed by governments or by private actors. And so I would respond to Gurumuthi's presentation. His attack on the neutrality principle is, I think he kind of missed the point, which was to institute a creative combination of open access and commons where it is most desirable in that bottleneck or potential bottleneck area, and to allow that to facilitate private entrepreneurship, individual creativity as much as possible. If you contrast the net neutrality concept with the .gpd proposal, for example, I think you could see that it would be far more sweeping, actually, much more fundamental to the organization of the internet than having a little sequestered domain in which you say, come on, everybody, put your stuff here, because, in fact, the internet has already created many common spaces, such as Wikipedia, without a special domain where people can share things in common. So I'll leave it at that. I hope, look forward to the discussion, and I thank Guru for his great presentation and the conceptualization of this resource. I mean, this workshop, I hope it doesn't get diverted into a debate about the definition of critical internet resources.
Thanks very much, Milton. And Willie, over to you for the last commentary before we open up for questions.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to channel a revisionist theory of international relations, which looks at the relationship between international regulatory regimes and globalization. put forward by U.S. academic Daniel Dresner in a recent publication, which is titled All Politics is Global. Essentially, Dresner argues that great power preferences shape and determine international regulatory regimes, such as the one we're discussing here, the ICANN regime. And he sets up a way of identifying who are the great powers in the world by setting up two criteria. The one is that a great power has a large internal market, and that enables it to be invulnerable to negative externalities. And he then looks at the size of the U.S. market as of about 5 years ago at $10 trillion, looks at the EU as having a market also of about $10 trillion. Next up is Japan with about half of that. And on the edges of this sit India and China with internal markets of approximately $1 trillion. He then moves to that, then he concludes is that at present there are two great powers in the world, the US and the EU. Then he looks at two critical moments in the growth of the internet, going back to the 70s with the acceptance of the TCP/IP protocol for exchanging information across computer networks, and in the 1990s, the creation of the ICANN regime for governing the internet domain name system. And essentially, he argues that governments took active steps in both of these instances to ensure that the outcome serviced their interests, and the management remained of critical internet resources remained private and amenable to state interests. I don't want to go too much into the incidents, but in the first case of the TCP/IP protocol, the argument is that great power governments in particular acted in concert to prevent private sector firms such as IBM and others who were developing proprietary standards from acquiring too much influence over the setting of standards. And in the second case, he argues that great powers acted to prevent a particular non-government organization, a particular international government organization, from acquiring too much influence over the management of critical internet resources. And essentially traces the history by which the ISOC and ITU International Ad Hoc Committee attempted to set up a GTLD MOU, which the US government shot down in concert with the European Union. And that led directly to President Clinton's executive order of 1997, authorizing the Department of Commerce's secretary to support efforts to make the government of the domain name system private and competitive, which, as we know, resulted in ICANN. And the knocking out of the ITU as a contender for the regulation of the domain name system. And then we saw in the WSIS process the return of the repressed, with ITU then making yet one more bid to seek to control, gain control of the domain name system, which was similarly dismissed, but not without a slight rupture between the USA and the European Union over the matter, what was left as a trace in the Tunis agenda of some kind of unknown enhanced cooperation process, which has never been activated, which was supposed to determine public policy principles for the management of critical internet resources. So both of these incidents were 20 years apart. And what I want to try and in drawing our attention to them is to say, let's assume there's some truth in this theory that great power preferences shape international regulatory regimes. We are likely to see over the next 20 years the entry of China and India as great powers into the global arena dealing not only with ICANN and the governance of the internet, but a range of other international regulatory regimes. And in a way, we've seen that China has shown its hand already. It actively supported the ITU as its candidate to take over the functions of ICANN during the WSIS process. I would speculate that China and the US will tend to neutralize each other on this issue. And what we then will see is a question over how will India enter this space? What positions are they going to take about the management of critical internet resources? And will they act in concert with the European Union? Or will the European Union continue to act in concert with the US? If we're looking ahead within the next 20 years, I think we can see perhaps this kind of shift in great power preferences. And I think it's interesting to consider India as perhaps the great power that may have some profound effect on this debate. And perhaps we will start to find that out at the IGF in Delhi next year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Willie. We have 15 minutes for questions. I'd like, before we turn to the panel to discuss among themselves, I would like to address questions from the floor. I think I can bring this microphone out into the audience, so if you raise your hands, gentlemen here.
Hello, my name is Hal Qualwasser. I am the chair of the US ITU Association. Let me say that while I think that this presentation has been certainly coherent, I don't view it as balanced or fair, and I have spent a great deal of time trying to address the question of how best governance of the domain name system, or what system of governance of the domain name system will best foster further growth of the internet and its expansion throughout the rest of the world. The approach you all have taken is an a priori approach in which you assume that certain kinds of governance are more important than what works. And I actually don't get to a very different result in some ways than you in the most ultimate of questions. But I can't subscribe to the view, I can't subscribe to the reasoning expressed by virtually anybody on the panel about how to get there. It seems to me that the first thing you have to start with is the question of whether the current structure has actually promoted the expansion and development of the internet. I think the logical answer to me is yes. I know, Guru, you say no, and we don't have time here to debate that. But I want to put on the record that I think that a very good case can be made that the current system has worked well if the test, if the metric is expansion of the internet in fairly fast form. I also think that if you go down the series of issues that that they have gone through, they have by and large been at least okay, perhaps good, about the decision-making process, particularly if the remit requires sort of worldwide, some attempt at worldwide participatory democracy, which seems to me to be a standard that the White and Green papers created that is virtually impossible to deal with. So we can't have the debate in the sense of going through point by point, but I do want to just put on the record that I think there is a contrary view. I wish that you all had come yesterday to the ICANN open house and just gone hammer and tongs with the ICANN management over these issues. And I would hope that at some point, if not in this IGF, then in the next IGF, you have that debate, because I think that at best or at worst, the truth lies somewhere in between. Thank you.
Try to be quick. The current structure, if by that you mean ICANN, has had nothing whatsoever to do with the growth of the internet as a whole. Now, just you had your say. You sit down. I'll talk. Okay? I'll answer you. All right. When you, I don't know what you're talking about by the current structure, then, and maybe we should leave that alone. But you know, ICANN has been a facilitator of competition in the registrar market. It has been a very serious break on the possibility of new top-level domains. It has acted like a cartel structure, as you perfectly know well. It has not had anything to do with the growth of the internet other than maintaining a consistent root zone file, which happened perfectly well for 10 years before ICANN even existed, which was done by one person sitting in a half-time position sitting in a university office, and could have continued to have been done by one person, you know, if all you're talking about is maintaining a consistent root zone file. So there are other issues to be looked at in terms of why this is becoming political now. It has to do with, you know, adjusting to the growth of the internet and possibilities for expansion and who controls these fundamental decisions.
Any other one from the panel want to address that? First, and then Jim.
I'll make a quick response. I think the point is very valid that there needs to be a debate and a discussion, and in all likelihood, the truth always lies somewhere in between. I think we are also looking at the nature of the internet having completely changed over the last 5 years, and arrangements that were perfectly valid or perfectly legitimate years back, when the internet was really a much smaller thing than it is today, would have been valid. But today we're talking about really an infrastructure that powers society, and the basic underlying principles of these are very important to look at. And the idea is not to bash any current structure, but to say that there is a great need to move forward. Can we get principles, like my esteemed colleague on the panel said, private and public have to coexist. And if ICANN is only competition and market and business and private sector return without any mention of the also the need for the public, then you're never going to get to the last billion. You can be sure about that. The public schooling system in no part of the world has been set up by the market. You always had public involvement in setting up the public school system. Both need to coexist. I'm not saying only one is sufficient. I think that is the point. So we need to look at new structure, new governance arrangements that can mature and lead to even better growth of the internet than we have had so far. Thanks.
I think that you misheard what the panel was saying in two regards. First of all, I think there was a greater diversity of views than you thought. Secondly, I think that at the end of the day, the panel was unified, I think, in that there is nothing better out there than the concept of ICANN as it now stands, and that the struggle, the debate, the process is over realizing that internationalized, multi-stakeholder, bottom-up decision-making process, which I think, with the exception of Fernando, who didn't have any alternative solution, that was, I think, the unanimous understanding and position of the members of the panel. So I do think that you and others, I fear, take the force of some of the criticism of ICANN and interpreted it as saying that ICANN should be somehow fundamentally changed. And I think that is a danger of the rhetoric of harsh criticism of ICANN. I think it's important to listen to the proposed solutions of the critics of ICANN. And I think by and large, with the exception perhaps of some governments, but certainly from a civil society perspective, the solution is ICANN is the best approach we've come up with. It needs to have its potential fulfilled. It has not yet reached its intended mandate, but it's the best we've got, and there's no proposal for radical change to that.
Thanks. I'd like to move on to, we have two questions in the front and then the gentleman in the back.
Thanks very much. I'm Paul Wilson from APNIC, which is the IP address registry for the Asia Pacific. I represent not only APNIC, but also the NRO, the Number Resource Organization, which is the umbrella of over all of the five RIRs. I think it bears repeating in this forum that the RIR system itself, responsible for IP address management throughout the world, and often lumped in the same bag or bath, if you like, as ICANN. We are quite separate from ICANN, entirely separate from ICANN. We support ICANN, we have formal agreements with ICANN, we receive our address space from ICANN, and we contribute fees to ICANN. We make voluntary contributions to ICANN, but we also predate ICANN by many years. We derive our authority and our legitimacy from the community of stakeholders in our in each of our regional processes, which are the primarily the ISPs who need and use addresses, but also through open processes anyone else, and an increasingly broad range of people who participate in these open bottom-up processes. If anyone is interested in the activities of the NRO, we've produced a report entitled Continuing Cooperation, the NRO's Role in Internet Governance. And due to shipping problems, we don't have the 2,000 copies here in Rio that we planned, but at our booth in the exhibition area, you can see copies of that. You can also put your name down and we'll send you a copy. But the question that I have coming to that is that, as I said, we're often thrown in the same bath as ICANN, and when we talk about the ICANN system for management of numbers and names and numbers, I think the RIRs are entitled to take that a little personally. So I'm interested in the views of the panelists as to how and whether and how you actually will distinguish your in your comments between ICANN and the RIRs, or whether the more radical positions that we might hear are possibly a case of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or in other words, do you see the RIRs as part of the problem or part of the solution? We put ourselves forward as actually best current practice in many respects as part of the solution, but I'm just interested in some specific comments from you in which you distinguish or don't in the way I've mentioned. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone volunteer? Carlos?
First of all, I think some of you heard me in the CIR panel on November 12. I am one of the ones who is very critical of the situation and not blaming ICANN itself for everything. What I'm saying is that within ICANN, there is a lot to be done to change the situation, but they have to be aware that this has to be changed. That's all. Secondly, I was crazy enough to advance a proposal for this to help this happen. And one of the things that I recognize in my proposal is that precisely the NRO is an example of autonomy which has been already achieved within the ICANN system. And this is a process that could continue. So I am not saying that we want to destroy something and replace by another thing. We are saying that there is a problem that must be recognized and there are things that must be done, and people in the so-called restricted internet community, which are the people that run the ICANN system in the countries, in the regions, and there in Marina del Rey or where the mother of all services is sitting, have a responsibility to consider that and proactively act to change this. That's my view, okay?
Thank you. We have 90 seconds left in this workshop. So, and we have at least three questions here and I think one in the back, so.
I will take 90 seconds for my introduction. My name is Bill Manning. I have a variety of roles in operational internet infrastructure. My question to the panel actually comes back to the statement that Bill Clinton signed promoting or encouraging competition. And while ICANN has certainly promoted a level of competition in one of the aspects of its charter, domain names, there is no competition for ICANN. And I think that the charter itself actually, or the statement from the U.S. government encourages
a discussion of competing or competitive environments, and I think that ICANN, without competition, has some issues with regard to accountability and nimbleness in moving forward as a monopoly position. Your comments, please.
Anyone else before I get to Milton? Milton's got his hand up first. Okay, Fernando, and then Milton, if you want to follow up.
Does it work? This one?
Okay.
What I try to do was just, as I said, to show a picture what the situation was as we agree originally. It didn't mean that I don't have my own ideas or how things should be. And again, I will re-emphasize what I said, that I think that ICANN is the worst until you compare with everything else, which means, yes, I think that ICANN should stay, but I will re-emphasize the issue that we need to go back to the legal relation, because as somebody said, now, where is the competition? It's just simply not. There are too many things that we take for granted, and for being politically correct, we say, well, we have different interpretation. There are certain things that are simply not true. So, as somebody clearly said, competition is just a myth in ICANN, and especially ICANN has no competition, that is one. What ICANN does is assign monopoly rights. It does not promote competition. They're two completely different things. And it's very interesting when somebody from the technological community it says, well, it is working, let's leave it there. Well, it depends. It is working. It's working for whom? Of course, it is true that any clarification, which normally businesses are happy with legal clarification, it takes one risk from you. You can make more money. Unless that clarification means that you are taking a right that you shouldn't have, like and too much influence in an organism. So the idea that I propose to have a clear mandate given by the proper legislative body, we will have to discuss who. It's a very complex political issue, and I understand that. United States doesn't want to give it up, and the rest of the countries don't want to recognize United States. Well, we will have to figure out. That is what we are here for, I mean, to think, if it's necessary, out of the box. If we are just coming here to repeat what you have in the textbook. I have all the same textbooks in the library, and I don't need to come to Rio to do that. So I think that we have to come up with some sort of proposals. And one proposal could be to analyze whether we need to establish a competing body against ICANN. I don't know how technically possible will be that. And in some point, we will have to have somebody unifying the whole thing. But we can probably try.
Yes. Institutional competition is very different from standard market competition, but it still can be very productive. Democracy is, in effect, a form of competition for political power, which is, instead of taking place through guns, takes place through votes. So could there be institutional competition with ICANN at the global level? I would go so far as to say that almost every advance that ICANN has made has been prompted by the threat or the possibility of some kind of competition. For example, they were afraid that there would be competing root systems, and that is what prompted them to take seriously new top-level domains. They were the similar threat prompted them to implement internationalized domain names. WSIS was the World Summit was a very important form of political competition with ICANN over authority, and it has led ICANN to make major improvements in its representational structures and in its approach to certain things in its staff and in its attitude. There have been major improvements in ICANN since WSIS. And then just to extend this into the RIR theme, one of the most interesting questions facing the RIRs is whether they will remain as regional monopolies on address space, or whether the assignment of address space from one will compete with the assignment of address spaces from another regional RIR. For obvious reasons, the internet registries are probably vociferously against any such competition, but it is an idea that should be explored and considered.
Thank you.
It's not necessarily a response, just a couple of quick comments based on past questions and comments. First one is the internet is a dynamic beast. There's no doubt about that. So organizations and debates around the internet need to be dynamic in nature and ever-changing. That's a granted. Second, the issue of competition for ICANN. Interesting concept. I'd really love to hear how exactly that could be implemented. And I would suggest that that will lead to another whole set of new debates, which may actually be never-ending as well. So I would rather expend our energies on what we have at the moment and hopefully try and shape that into something better rather than trying to reinvent the wheel again. Thank you.
Me? Okay, thank you. My name is Gadi Evron. I'm with Aphelios. And I would actually like to ask for the panel's patience for a second and ask for help. I'm at a complete loss, I have to admit. And I realize this is probably what we would call mailing lists off topic, but I'm very good at that, as some of you may know. Yesterday, and I realize these discussions are important, not in any way taken away from that. Yesterday I went to, on the 12th, I went to the session called CIR, Critical Internet Resources. And I was there, just on my row, with a law enforcement officer from the from Europe, a CERT, a critical emergency response team member from the United States, a researcher from Korea, and some other people. There were a lot of different individuals in the crowd. There was a question asked about malicious domains. It was shut down, but never mind that. Some people passed on questions. I've seen them about issues about critical internet infrastructures, and I understand the panel had other issues discussed. My question is this. Is critical internet infrastructures, because honestly I was really lost that day and today again, a new buzzword for continued discussion of ICANN. I realize, please hold on a second, I realize discussion of ICANN is important. I realize that a lot of people are, okay, I'll use the word pissed, peeved, whatever you want to call it, about ICANN, the ITU, the way the domain name management system is run, the names on the internet, who has the money from these domains, if .xxx happens, I understand these are important issues. Now, my question is, if we are here to sit down in two whole sessions about critical internet resources, and even if we are to ignore what just happened in Estonia, where critical resources, where anything from communicating online and once the internet is down, honestly, we don't have a way to communicate except on the internet if there are any nodes left on some sort of other network on the internet, never mind that now. Whether Google or MSN or Yahoo are critical resources, the root servers, we all agree the root servers are critical resources. Why? I really want to know if I'm just misunderstanding the concept, really looking for help here, of what critical resources are on the internet if we don't care about them when open warfare is going on. So my question is to clarify, and please help me here, when you write in the program, we are going to talk about critical internet resources twice, does that mean we're going to rehash ICANN discussions which are important, or does it mean we're also going to get to talk about governing critical resources that may go down or may be in danger or are in danger right now, and even discussing what they are? Because honestly, I don't understand. I would like to. Thank you.
Before the panel responds, there is another workshop here at 2:30. So I'd like the responses to be quick. We have one more question here. Point of clarification, the main sessions and the workshops were meant to complement each other. So on that, I think there's no confusion on the substance of the question. If we can have two of the panelists respond and then move on to the next question, please. Jim, you want to start?
Well, at some level, I agree with the questioner, although I think that the definition of critical internet resources matters less than that we know what we're talking about at each individual resource. Domain names are a critical internet resource. They have been part of the debate. They should be part of the debate. In my view, they are not the sum of the debate. And I think there is a risk that treating them as the sum of the debate lets some people off the hook, people who are responsible for other critical internet resources that are not being, I think, fully addressed or might not be addressed under this notion of governance. And the one example that I put on the table was communications infrastructure, which is a critical resource that is governed largely by national regulatory bodies, which in many countries have failed their responsibilities to create an open, competitive environment that supports innovation and development. So there's no doubt that ICANN is part of the critical internet resources debate, but it is in the column of domain names and IP addresses. The other elements have their own governance structures that have problems which in some ways far overshadow the problems of ICANN, where we are talking about a relatively narrow range of dispute, namely making ICANN more effective in fulfilling its stated form as a multi-stakeholder non-governmental representative and international decision-making body.
Yes, I think I thought that in the beginning I explained why ICANN, when it's not clearly the one dealing with every critical internet resource. The problem is we cannot talk about everything at the same time, and not even if we take the whole week for that. So we need to choose something that can exemplify, and then we can translate the same principles to a different story. So when I was just trying to show a picture of the legal conundrum around ICANN and the relations between the different parties, the same could be applied to anything that have to do with critical internet resources. That is the reason of ICANN, because it's easier to just create a model that we can use. It did not imply, and I think one slide said that clearly, it does not imply that it's the only one, but it's the one that makes easier for us to understand the topic.
Thank you to the panel. Just one request, please next time write ICANN political discussion rather than critical internet resources. I would appreciate it. Thank you.
You can't separate those two.
Still
I can take the opportunity also to remember that the word domains to the humanity, consequently to United Nations, has a meaning as a word. Of course, that's not the meaning that ICANN use, because the word domain came before. I suppose that we are here discussing what's the meaning of domain. What's the meaning of geopolitical in virtualities? And also, it's interesting to all the nations to discuss humanities. It's not a technical forum. It's a place to discuss the future of humanity. So based on that, I considered that meeting here in this room very important and fundamental to decide what kind of institution we are going to have to manage the domains, who will be submitted to whom, and would recommend three philosophers to discuss that. The philosopher of the public sphere, Habermas, of course, and the technical people here could read a bit more about that. Because if you don't understand Habermas, you cannot understand the meaning of domains, right? The second philosopher is called Deleuze, and subjectivity is another aspect that we need to remember to discuss in United Nations, probably. And the third one, Michel Foucault, practice and discourses. Sometimes we are hearing things that don't correspond to the actions in the real world. My point is that critical resource to all the nations.
Any final words from the panel before we let the other workshop come in? No? Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers. Thank you all for attending. Thank you, panelists. And enjoy the rest of the day. Goodbye.